Hey everybody, how's it going? We're getting ready to jump into this delicious episode, but you know, just wanted to let y'all know, it was recorded a little while ago, so some of our, you know, references might be dated. I think
screenwriter Larry Karaszewski on Twitter this week said, "This pandemic has lasted so long, I've already forgotten what Tiger King was." So yeah. When we did this episode, the Bon Appetit test kitchen was seemed a lot nicer than we maybe later found out it was. And Animal Crossing was new. That's how much things have changed. So this might seem a little anachronistic, but, you know, we put off the Fat Max Fun Drive. But otherwise, other than that, this show is tight and fresh.
Oh, yeah. Ooh, fresh and tight. Yeah, someone reminded me that Parasite won Best Picture this year. And I was like, oh, that feels a decade ago. So
I thought it was like the Hollywood in the 70s, right?
Yeah. But, you know, like Alonzo said, Max Fun Drive is here. That means it's a great time to check out that bonus content. And just because you've supported us doesn't mean that you only get our bonus content. You get all of Max Fun's bonus content. So that's a lot of delicious bonus tent to keep you going through this teen.
So yeah, just a quick reminder, the Who Shot You bonus content, we did a deep dive into Cats, not just the movie, also the video of the Broadway show with comedian Joey Clift. I am still coughing up hairballs.
Now, if you're super inspired by phrases like, we bring the tent to your teen, and want to become a member, you can do so at MaximumFun.org/join. Choose an amount that fits within your monthly budget. It could be $5 a month, $10 a month, $20 a month. Sky is literally the limit. Whatever level you choose, your support, combined with that of other Max Fun members like you, enable us to keep producing this show. And we love making this show. And I think that, dang it, we're unlike every other show, and we're a scrappy little underdog. Man, I love being a scrappy underdog. Anyway, that's MaximumFun.org/join to sign up and see all the cool gifts available. And thanks for all of the support.
Yes.
Thanks for that, Drea. But I think it's time to jump right into the show. So let's get it in.
Careful, man. There's a beverage here, huh?
Does anybody here know how many times I've had to watch Funny Lady?
I'm going to get that gun of mine, and I'm going to change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Who Shot Ya? What's up? It's your host, Ify Whitey Way, in the digital booth with my friends, and it's time to get it in. We're taking it back this week, but first, let's introduce the guest, Alonzo Duralde. Alonzo, what's good?
I'll tell you what's good, Ify. I am married to somebody who is obsessed with the Bon Appetit test kitchen videos, which means he makes things like ricotta raspberry cake and, you know, all kinds of other stuff. I don't have to watch them. I don't have to cook anything. I just sit down and these things appear in front of me. So if you can get a spouse or significant other to watch these videos, it will improve your life greatly.
Yeah, I've been seeing those. Everyone has been hyped on it. I haven't started watching the Bon Appetit videos, but I think they'd be up my alley because your boy likes to cook.
They are so good.
They went nuts on Thanksgiving, so, you know, just get ready.
Oh, and that other voice that said it's so good, they're so good. It's producer and film festivals programmer Drea Clark. Drea, what's good?
Well, first I want to validate husband's Alonzo's choice in husband once again. Dave White coming through with things that I love. The BA Test Kitchen videos are fantastic, and you will very quickly become obsessed with everyone that works there. I don't even cook, and I love watching those. What's good for me is recently, back for my birthday, a group of friends and I went to Palm Springs and we locked ourselves away, and we played, we found this game. It was basically these unsolved mysteries you can get, and it's sort of a variation of those, you know, those dinner parties where everyone's like assigned a character and then like, dun, dun, this person died, and you have to like solve things with each course. You get all of this evidence and, a whole folder of things with photos and testimony and the forensic report. And so you're basically getting to solve a crime, and it's not a real crime, so you don't have to feel terrible about it. But a lot of my friends are very big true crime heads, and so this scratches an itch for them. And I just like to play things. So this is fun. And it's not online. It's tangible and tactile. And I love that. And you can also do it remotely. Like I've been doing one with my family where one of us got the case file, I guess, and then took pictures of everything and sent it to the rest of the team so we could all study the different evidence. Anyway, you guys, basically, I'm a great detective, and it's about time you know that.
And what are these called, Rhea?
They're under different names. I think there's a couple like smaller companies that sell them on Amazon. There's one called Unsolved Case Files. I think they only have one mystery currently available. But yeah, I've just been seeking them out. I found some on Etsy. Just Google stuff that will put you on a watch list. Like, I'd like to solve a murder, and you'll get there.
Untraceable poisons.
Exactly. Exactly.
I wonder what watch list that would be, because I feel like that's a good watch list where it's like, okay, this is someone we come to when we've like reached our wit's end and we have a civilian who knows about puzzles.
Whereas if he's on the erotic body pillow FBI watch list.
Oh yeah, definitely. No, I'm definitely on that same FBI watch list from the FBI who came to my house when I was 16. They're like, we're still watching you. You can't be trusted. And our last guest is comedian, writer, actor, friend, and host of the great movie podcast, How Did This Get Made and Unspooled? It is Paul Scheer. Paul, what's good?
Well, first of all, I have one thing that is good, but it's only personally good to me, which is I bought a bouncy castle on Amazon for my 3-year-old and a 5-year-old, and the days of being quarantined in our house just got so much easier because they've spent like 4 hours in it today. So like the relief that you're hearing in my voice is just happiness that they have found joy and could move their bodies freely. I feel like the best parent in the world, even though I'm sitting 10 feet away from them on my phone while they are bouncing in that castle. But look it up, Amazon, get those bouncy castles. They should still be on Prime.
Yeah, you just opened my brain up. I just had Naomi for the weekend, and I took her. We literally walked 3 miles, and we got in, and she was like still amped up. And also, yeah. When kids see each other on the street, they act like they've never seen another kid in their life. They're like, oh.
I know we are taking them out of everything that they know is normal and natural, but for those of you without kids, I'm going to tell you what's good is this game I just found on Xbox. I know it's a little bit old, but I thought maybe you would all like it because it fits into this podcast. It's Friday the 13th, The Game, and it's a multiplayer game where some of you are camp counselors and one of you is Jason, and you have to hunt down the camp counselors or run away from Jason. It's amazing. It's like Halo, but with Jason, and you can pick every version of Jason from any of the Friday the 13th movies, including the NES version of Jason. And when he gets close to you, the NES theme song plays, not the actual Jason song, but you have to whisper to your partners when you're playing online because you know if the Jason hears you talking, he'll find you. So it's not like Halo where everyone's talking at the same time. Like it is recognized by distance, and it's a pretty great fun game in this time of just trying to find ways to connect with people online and stuff like that.
But can you be Betsy Palmer? That's the big question.
I don't think it gets specific with the camp counselors because they don't have enough data to hold in any game for the amount of camp counselors that Jason has decimated over the years.
I mean, Mrs. Voorhees from the first movie, can you be her?
I mean, isn't that her? Jason 1 is Miss Voorhees.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. You said Jason, so I wanted to make sure.
So technically, yes. Yeah.
Excellent.
Alonzo is practicing some real gotcha journalism with this one.
I need to know. The public has a right to know.
Yo, no, you know I already was deep in there. There's actually like two versions of that game. Just amp it up for all the people listening. So there's Dead by Daylight, which uses the exact same function and is basically the same game. The only difference is Friday the 13th exists in that universe, which it's super fun. I find them both very fun. But whereas you live in the world of Friday the 13th, Dead by Daylight implements Saw. It implements Freddy Krueger. You can play as... and then there's like Leatherface, I think, is in there. And there's like archetypes that they'll go by. So it's like old forgotten Egyptian princess who hunts you down. So if you're really into that, I'd say try Dead by Daylight next. And same thing, the sound design is on point. If you start hearing your heartbeat, you know the monster's getting closer, and it scares the living mess out of me. So I'm so hyped that you're into that game.
Iffy, what's good?
Oh man. Well, what's good with me is Animal Crossing New Horizons is out, if you haven't been on Twitter at all, period. If you don't know what Animal Crossing is, it's a very social, simple game where you are on a deserted island with a community of animals, and you're just there's this form of currency that exists within the game that you trade in things you find on the island to make money. And really, it is just what's that one, like, always referenced in everything, home design magazine, Better Living, I think.
Oh yeah.
It's Better Living the game. All you're trying to do is just like accessorize your house, reformat your gardens. You plant flowers. It's so chill. And you know, it came out the same day as Doom Eternal. So when you're all kind of like, done with blowing, like literally ripping out, there's a move in Doom Eternal where you like rip off this spider demon's arm and stick it in its eyes, and like rock music is blasting the whole time. You can kind of decompress by going to your Nintendo Switch, going to an island, and just watering some flowers.
I was really wrestling with getting this game. I felt like I was going to be afraid that it was going to be such a time suck and addictive for no real reason. But every time I hear people talk about it, they talk about it in such a loving way that I feel like I have to do it. I have to look at this game.
Yeah, it's such a chill game. And Naomi loves just sitting on my lap and like, I'll just ask her what she thinks I can do next. And then if you have a few older kids, so they can, it's something simple that they can play too. Like, you're literally just pulling weeds from the ground, planting trees, and everything is cute. It's the cutest game ever. It makes you want to scream. But now it's time to just let y'all know what we got coming on in this show. This show, we're taking it back. We're doing a retro rewind episode of Who Shot Ya, and we're climbing into our time machines and going back to the year 1987, where I was a mere zygote in my dad's body. And we're going to discuss adventures and babysitting. And plus, we also got some staff picks from 1987. First, it's time for our new segment, normally called It a Dick, short for Is This Important, Do I Care? But since we're talking about the past, it must be renamed Would a Dick, aka Was This Important, Do I Care? Each of us will read a new segment from the year 1987, and we will answer the question, Was This Important, Do I Care? And first up, we have the 59th Academy Awards. On March 30th of 1987, the 59th Academy Awards took place at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion in Los Angeles. The ceremony was hosted by the trio Chevy Chase, Goldie Hawn, and Crocodile Dundee himself, Paul Hogan. Platoon won the Academy Award for Best Picture and Best Director for Oliver Stone. Best Actor went to Paul Newman for The Color of Money, and Best Actress went to Marlee Matlin for Children of a Lesser God. Hannah and her sisters picked up Best Supporting Actor and Actress for Michael Caine and Diane Wiest, and it won Best Original Screenplay for Woody Allen. Best Adapted Screenplay Oscar went to Ruth Prover Javala for Room with a View. And was this important? Do you care?
It was important-ish as much as the Oscars ever are.
Yes.
look, it's the Academy Awards are rarely important, but in the mid-80s, you were seeing this explosion of indie cinema making itself known in the upper echelons of Hollywood. The previous year, you know, you'd had William Hurt win Best Actor for A Kiss of the Spider-Woman, and Geraldine Page won Best Actress for The Trip to Bountiful, both of which were these, you know, very small, very independently produced films. And then now you've got like Platoon and Room with a View, which were also very kind of off Hollywood films that were scoring big. So it was the beginning of an invasion of the sort of the end of the major studio hegemony over the Oscars that, you know, certainly Harvey Weinstein would later really run roughshod over.
So, you know, 87 to me is such an amazing year for film. And it's a lot of the films that I think I connected with as a kid, I guess. I'm probably a little bit older than you guys, and there's so much good stuff in this year, like Princess Bride, and you know that, like, you know, that live on for such a long time. You also have Evil Dead this year, Evil Dead 2, I believe, you know, and Inner Space, and all these like kind of really cool films. And I always embrace a year where like very bizarre ideas are getting out into the world. Like Princess Bride is a movie that I feel like you can't make anymore, or even like Stakeout with like Richard Dreyfuss and Emilio Estevez. Like I just feel like they were taking more chances in film. And yes, these are amazing movies. Platoon is, I don't know, would you give Platoon the Academy Award for Best Picture in retrospect?
Well, I mean, I remember what a big deal that movie was when it came out, because I think, you know, I'm a little older than you, Paul. I was in college in 1987. You know, there had been obviously that sort of first wave of kind of prestige-y Vietnam movies like The Deer Hunter and Coming Home. But this one gave such, was so immediate and felt so kind of first person. You know, I think really we had not seen the war depicted that way before. We hadn't seen a Vietnam War movie that was directed by somebody who'd been there. And, right. And so I think it was really intense. And I think it's one of those movies where it has since, so much of that movie has become sort of copied or parodied, or has, you know, feels cliche. The whole Willem Dafoe Christ pose, you know, has become a joke now, but at the time it was new, you know. And and in the moment, I mean, I remember very much thinking that was totally the way to go.
You know, I've watched a bunch of these Vietnam films because of Unspooled. A lot of them are on the list, and you can kind of see like who the people that vote on the AFI list are, because they feel like about the same age. And there are so many Vietnam films, and this is the one that does feel to me in many respects the most realistic. The other ones feel like people playing at war, you know. And while I love Apocalypse Now, I think it's a great movie, it's not really like a grounded Vietnam film. And Deer Hunter, also not a grounded, you know, film. MASH is supposed to take place in Korea, but is really kind of Vietnam. But like that, like there is something about that film that I think feels more gritty and real. And that's, I mean, and I think you're also getting that in other movies this year. I mean, even like, I don't know, I have just a big affinity to 87 with like Lethal Weapon and Raising Arizona. I really love too. It's just like, it's a great year. I just think that, you know, you look back on that year and Children of a Lesser God, I don't think people are talking about that. I don't think that people talk about Platoon that much anymore. And I think it's this weird zone of where, you know, what stays and lasts the time, you know, like the stands the test of time. And I feel like that year doesn't really stand the test of time from the Academy Award standpoint.
I protest against Paul. I talk about Children of a Lesser God all the time, which is maybe indicative of how fun I am to hang out with. But Children of a Lesser God is notable as well. It's the first Best Picture nominee that had a female director, Rhonda Haynes or Rhonda Haynes. And it's also one of the films that I've used as a recent reference of the times when, you know, there's so much talk now of, especially in important movies, but even more so on the independent level, of people telling stories with an underrepresented audience in mind, either via the characters or the creators or some creation of both. Children of a Lesser God was, you know, based on a stage play that was created about a deaf woman. There was an actual deaf actress who played the lead and then won the Oscar for that. And I think that it's a good example of sort of expanding the toolbox of the stories that you're trying to do. So I think that one is still pertinent and interesting.
Well, I mean, do you think that that's more pertinent than Howard the Duck, where we really understand we really understand about this duck who comes to this planet? We've never seen a movie with a duck, and all the different things and how he gets involved in rock music. I mean, and you know, I'm going to say, if we're talking about different cultures being represented, Crocodile Dundee and Howard the Duck both are showing you a side of life that we never really saw before.
That the is such a good better. Point. Yeah, I acquiesce. I release my time. All right. Well, in a totally different vein, before there was John McClane, there was Bruno. And that is a real thing for so many people are not going to know what the return of Bruno is. But you guys, in 1987.
This is my favorite thing of all time.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that's telling. Well, Bruce Willis released the debut album, The Return of Bruno. The debut album, The Return of Bruno. I love that already. The album peaked at number 14 on the Billboard 200. The biggest hit off the album was a cover of the Pointer Sisters' Respect Yourself, which he did with the Pointer Sisters Because if you're going to have the raw arrogance to be a white actor making a blues album, you might as well collaborate. Let's listen, shall we?
Can I just say that I own this on vinyl?
Oh, well, I do too.
You could say that, but you know people will hear you.
but here's the thing. I was a huge fan of Moonlighting, right? I love Moonlighting. I was not savvy more than I love Moonlighting. Bruce Willis is hilarious in it. And he's a singer too, besides those Seagram's wine cooler commercials. Get me in. And I didn't even understand that Under the Boardwalk was a cover. I thought Under the Boardwalk was like a Bruce Willis original. Like and that's the crazy thing. Like, I listened to that album going like, wow, he wrote all these songs. Under the Boardwalk is a good song. So Respect Yourself, I didn't know that was a cover either. It's crazy. I know all those songs in my head because it was like, it just, the cult of personality. I was like, I love this guy. I need to embrace him in every way. And now I think it's one of the funniest things. And there's so many live videos of him. I mean, he kind of outdoes Jim Belushi as far as doing blues in front of people in the 80s. And it's pretty amazing.
Like, I am a non-ironic fan of Hudson Hawk, and even this record is too much for me. and I bought it at the time as a goof, but I do still own it because it's one of those things where I come across it in my collection. I'm like, I can't not have this, even though I'm never, ever going to listen to it again.
Iffy, I'm assuming you're a big fan of The Return of Bruno.
No, I didn't even know this existed until right now. But I can't talk too much smack because I was bumping Shaq and Kobe's album.
Right, that's the whole thing. So it's like you get bought into this cult of personality. Like, I gotta get this thing. I mean, Shaq's still recording music. Him and Dame Lillard are going at each other, or they were at the beginning of this season.
Yeah, I always get surprised because Spotify really keeps forcing Dame Lillard songs into, like, I don't want to hear a rapper. I mean, I don't want to hear a basketball player talk about being rich. We know. Let me talk to somebody who, like, sold drugs to get rich, okay?
What year did Eddie Murphy release Party All the Time?
See, that was another one. That's a certified bop, in my opinion.
Yeah, Party All the Time. Like, Eddie Murphy is, like, I think the most talented out of the three. Like, I think Eddie Murphy, like, when he went into that reggae phase, which was only a couple years ago,
yeah,
released that reggae album, that was interesting. Yeah. But I actually think, like, I've heard this story, this rumor, and it could be totally false, but let's just believe that it's true, that, like, Eddie Murphy and Michael Jackson were such good friends, they recorded an album together in Eddie Murphy's studio at his house, and they've just never released it. Like, he's like, oh yeah, I have all these tracks that we just did together, we just never released it. And I would love to hear that collaboration at one point, the two of them, what they were cooking up in that studio.
Can you even imagine?
I know, I gotta know.
So these are the top 10 films at the box office in 1987. And again, as we always discover in years past, you could be an adult drama and, you know, make a lot of money. So number one was Beverly Hills Cop 2. Then number two was Platoon. Number three, Fatal Attraction, The Untouchables, Three Men and a Baby, The Secret of My Success, Stakeout, Lethal Weapon, The Witches of Eastwick, and rounding out at number 10, Predator. Was this important? Mm. Do you care?
Hell yeah, I care. What's the most shocking to you on that list?
For me,
it's Secret of My Success, because that I don't even think was a good movie back in the, like, I mean, it was a fine movie, but that's not like Back to the Future. Secret of My Success means that Michael J. Fox was so popular that movie, like, willed itself into the top 10.
Yeah, he was, you know, he was smoking hot off of the, I think Family Ties was still on the air at this point, and he had the Back to the Future trilogy happening. So, yeah, he could coast in with a fairly, you know, as time has proven, forgettable rom-com and nail it. I mean, the Three Men and a Baby phenom, this was like peak Hollywood remake of French comedy period, directed by Leonard Nimoy, by the way.
Oh, yes.
Really? Oh, that's wild.
Leonard Nimoy, also an erotic photographer.
Yes, he is. Three Men and a Baby will always be memorable to me because I looked at the lineup of Tom Selleck, Ted Danza and Steve Guttenberg and decidedly thought, yes, Guttenberg, please. Like, no joke. That was my dude. I was like, oh, move aside. Let me get my eyes on
He was a sex symbol.
Oh, yeah.
He was a sex symbol. Like, he really was. Like, he was, it's crazy. Like, you know, and it's weird how we like how things have changed. But he was just like a normal looking guy. Like, and he was a straight up, like, leading man sex symbol.
Well, you see him in those shorts and Can't Stop the Music. And
right. The best movie he ever did, of course, Can't Stop the Music. But Guttenberg also had a version of the Stanley Tucci where he was like surprisingly jacked always. And you just wouldn't guess it if you looked at a headshot.
Can we also talk about Beverly Hills Cop 2, which I am a huge, again, bringing back Eddie Murphy, huge Eddie Murphy fan. Beverly Hills Cop 1 and 2 are, again, like just like some of my favorite films. Or I don't even know, because they're just like so ingrained in me. Do people like these movies, or is this just something that I love?
It's funny. This week, Jesse Malton was tweeting about, you know, wanting to do some sort of online viewing parties and what are some older films that you would like us to watch? And somebody piped in, well, I'm really old school, so I like movies from the 80s. And so... So yeah, I think for a lot of the youngs, the Beverly Hills Cop movies are sort of like the Marx Brothers, like just this thing they think like, oh yeah, older people like that, and they were really popular, but it never meant anything to me.
But they are super fun. I mean, if you rewatch them or if you see them for the first time, also anyone who was alive at the time and had access to a keyboard or a piano learned how to play Axel F.
Oh yeah.
So like, if anything, the cultural impact of that can't be ignored. Iffy, have you seen all these?
I've seen Beverly Hills Cop. I've seen Fatal Attraction. I think I like saw bits and pieces of Three Men and a Baby, Lethal Weapon, of course, and Predator. I can't believe I missed Witches of Eastwick. I think
but you
love
the
so
ABC show Witches of Eastwick, so that's odd. Oh, you never went back.
Yeah, that's why it's on my mind.
Can I talk about one other movie that is on that is came out this year that I think is worthy of a mention? And again, it may just be my old man brain. But Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, like the only R-rated John Hughes comedy, Steve Martin, John Candy. This is like a classic in my household. I think it's like you could classify it as a Thanksgiving movie. There's very few Thanksgiving movies like Home for the Holidays with Holly Hunter, I think is one. This is probably the other. But Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is just I think the perfect buddy road movie.
I think about the only other major Thanksgiving movie is Hannah and Her Sisters, weirdly enough.
Speaking of Thanksgiving, I'm gonna give thanks to all of y'all while we take a quick break. Oh, solid segue. But when we come back, we'll be talking about Adventures in Babysitting just as soon as we hear from another one of the shows on Maximum Fun.
Hey, how's it going, y'all? Hope you're feeling good. Hope you've been enjoying the episode so far. You know, it's time to talk about the Max Fun Drive, and this time I wanted to hit up Super Producer Casey and have him hop in. I think he has a couple of things to say.
Hi, guys. It's great to be here. As you know, I'm a very important part of this show, so I just wanted to jump in and give my two cents here. You know, we have total creative control over this show, and it's because we are supported by members. Yeah, I mean, we put a lot of effort into this show every week. These guys got to see those damn movies. They come in, record, and you know, your monthly contributions allow them to make this show possible.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think one of the things that we've been seeing over the last 10, 20 years with the internet kind of becoming the main way that people get their media is the assumption from a lot of people that, oh, well, if it's on the internet, it should be free. And, you know, ask anybody who works at a daily newspaper, ask anybody who works at a record label how that system is working out for everybody and for creators of content, as they sort of put us all under that umbrella term. So, yeah, you know, this show requires effort on our parts and time and all of that stuff. And it is great that, you know, we
are compensated for that. And the reason that we are is because listeners like you guys step up and support Max Fun, and you support the efforts of all the shows that are happening here. And the people who are supporting Who Shot Ya are the ones who are keeping Who Shot Ya alive and making it something that Iffy and Dre and I and Casey certainly can devote the time to, devote the energy and the effort that comes into these seemingly effortless bon mots that we shower upon you every week.
Yeah, just to add on that, I think something that maybe isn't totally clear with how the membership system works, it's not like, you know, all the money is going into a big pot and then it's evenly dispersed between podcasts. It acts more as a this company acts more as a Patreon. So you have to specifically give to our show, and we get those contributions. So that's just, you know, it makes it all the more important for listeners of this show to contribute and support this show so that it can continue to grow and become the biggest podcast in the world. Alonzo, would you like to explain how to become a member?
Absolutely. It's super easy. You go to MaximumFun.org/join, and just starting at $5 a month, you get all the bonus content. Every show on this network has created new and extra content, and you can access all of it for just $5 a month. You know, some people give more than that. You want to give $50 a month, $100 a month? We're not going to say no to that, but it's most important that you give to what's comfortable for your budget. We think you'll like being a member. We certainly want you to stick around. And yeah, like Casey says, you do get to sort of personalize your donation to Max Fun. It's not like, you know, giving money to your college in the hopes they're going to put it into the library and they just build a football field with it. You get to say when you become a donor, I like Who Shot Ya. I listen to Who Shot Ya. I want Who Shot Ya to get a chunk of this donation.
Max Fun would never build a football field, just to be very clear with that analogy.
I don't know. I've been petitioning for the new Chargers Max Fun Stadium. So.
Sure, sure.
So, in looking at the levels of membership, if the level that you're comfortable with is the $10 a month, then good news for you, friend. Not only do you get to choose a cool pin to wear this week, all our members at $10 and above have the option to purchase additional pins from the store. If you haven't seen our pin yet, it is sweet. It says, "For the thirsty."
Ooh, yeah.
Which weirdly, I feel like reflects maybe Iffy more than the rest of us.
A little bit.
I feel
like we are all equally thirsty on this pod.
That's true. You can get additional pins from the store, and all the proceeds from these additional pin purchases go to charity. There are many great ones to choose. The Switchblade Sisters pin is to die for. Ooh, I love it so much. I want my greasy mitts on that enamel pin right now.
But all jokes aside, we're extremely grateful to everyone who has give, everyone who's listening to this as they're hitting the give button, and those who can't but are sharing and blasting us out to get more listeners. I think, you know, everyone, you know, I don't want you to get caught up in being like, oh man, I'd love to give more. What you can do is keep talking about us, keep sharing us, and the getting listeners in here, and then those people will give.
Yes, thank you to everybody who's been supportive. It means everything to us, because not just the fact that, you know, yeah, we like I said, we put work into the show and it's nice to be compensated for it, but you know, you're voting with your dollars and you're saying, hey, this is a show that means something to me. This is a show that has value to me. And so, you know, that's always lovely to hear.
So if you want to become a member, go to MaximumFun.org/join. And speaking of join, let's join ourselves back on the rest of this pod. Welcome back to Who Shot Ya. I'm your host, Iffy Whitey Way. In the virtual stew with me are
Drea Clark,
Paul Shear,
Alonzo Duraldi.
And today we're talking about adventures in babysitting. Paul, would you mind providing a light synopsis of the movie?
Okay, so Adventures in Babysitting is a Christopher Columbus comedy about a babysitter who is forced to take the kids that she is watching on an adventure to go pick up her friend. And from the minute they leave the house, they get into a ton of trouble, from a flat tire to getting cornered by a bunch of crooks to having to sing in a blues club to literally climbing outside of one of the biggest buildings in Chicago. It has elements of Ferris Bueller's Day Off because they need to get home safely before the parents return home that night. I think it's a tour de force by Elizabeth Shue and a real classic. Again, for me.
This was my first time watching it, and I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed seeing a smoking hot Vincent D'Onofrio. I've only seen him as the Roach in MIB and Kingpin, really. So this was, I was like, this is a side I didn't know.
In one summer, he was in this and in Full Metal Jacket as Private Pyle.
Oh my God, yes, he was. Yeah, that's two totally different
looks.
That's
when the world met Vincent D'Onofrio.
Oh, well, by the way, When this movie first opened up, you know, because I haven't seen it in a little bit of time, I was like, who is this Bradley Whitford looking motherfucker? And I was like, oh, it's Bradley Whitford. He's like a very young Bradley Whitford.
I had no idea that he had that period.
He's not that
young. No, they all look 40.
They are 40. That is one of the things in rewatching this that, you know, Elizabeth Shue's meant to be a teenager. She's meant to be 17. She's 24. Bradley Whitford is a 28 going on 40. He looks like he has an investment portfolio, but he has like a letter jacket practically, which I love that in 80s movies. I'm a big fan of casting the elderly as teenagers.
Oh, it's such a staple. I think it's partly the hair, partly the clothes, and then they just look, because the hair also makes them look so much older. But yeah, you know, by the way, that was actually Bradley Whitford's Camaro and his actual license plate, apparently. That's what I my little bit of research had showed that.
Well, I have kind of an Adventures in Babysitting story. I was a bright-eyed college intern at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution the summer that movie came out, and one of my assignments was I interviewed Elizabeth Shue and Maya Bruton, who plays the little girl, because they were like, you know, touring the country doing publicity. So like, she was my first ever celebrity interview, and it was for this movie.
Oh, wow. How were they?
They were lovely. They were charming. Like, the kid was already giving me side eye. Like, she was that was like a 40-year-old, 7-year-old. She was not having anything. But no, they were lovely. And I loved the movie at the time. And last night was the first time I had watched it in, you know, a couple of decades. And I gotta admit, I found it a little cringy at times, because this is not a movie that is out to like goof on the mentality of white suburban teens. I think it's there to underscore and confirm the mentality of white suburban teens.
I mean, look, this is the problem with all of these movies. When you go back and watch them, it is super cringy. I mean, there are so many moments where you're like, oh boy. And it's hard. I mean, it's like a hard thing to wrestle with. Yeah, it is problematic. There are some really great things about it, but in the scheme of problematic films, I think it's less problematic. But then you also have like a full scene where like Thor's a homo. You're like, oh wow, yeah. Okay, well, interesting. That's like right out of the gate.
The whole blues club thing. It's like, we're treating all of these people like aliens now.
That was, with me, it was so funny because this was my first time watching. And I was so taken aback, because it was like there were so many things I was like, oh, cool. Because you have like the progressiveness of this little girl who's into comic books and into nerd culture, which like someone embedded in nerd culture, like that is like a progressive thing, because there's been this long-standing ideal that women and girls don't like comics. So that was kind of cool to see. But then it's followed up by this like conversation about Thor's sexuality that was like, it was so like a non-issue. Like, it wasn't an issue that he was saying it. It was an issue that he was making fun of Thor. And I was like, oh, right. Yeah, this is a whole different era we're in. And then, yeah, that I was kind of surprised, because I was like, okay, there's all like, when you have that first downtown like bus station subway scene, it was like all these people who were like ne'er-do-wells, none of them were black. And then I was like, okay, all right, we're off to a good start. And then we go to the shop and the same thing, like it was a well diverse shop where it wasn't just like the black people doing crime, but then we have the brother putting in work the whole, like, I don't believe that just because you save the day you know win the girl, you know, it's 2020, we're beyond that. But if we're in 1987 and we're saying those rules, why are we giving the guy who gave $45 the girl versus the man who risked his life to save her, and she not a second thought, she did it just really did kind of like lean on that, like, oh, this is what they're talking about, where there's like this desexualization of black men, because like it was like he wasn't even a contender in this, like this kind of subplot of her trying to find someone to replace this slime ball boyfriend is like this handsome black dude with good cornrows who like is quick on his feet, who is willing to stand up for her honor, and he's like a non-question, he's just happy to see her get home. Psych.
That but totally stood out to me too.
Yeah
I had such a thing watching it.
He's stuck being Bagger Vance in this movie.
Yeah, that guy in any other movie, that guy would have been the love interest. Although, again, he's not a great criminal in that he didn't kick them out immediately of the car and then, you know, brought them to the scene of operation.
He was protecting them. He was protecting them.
He's a
Come
good
on.
Dude.
He said he couldn't kick them out in that neighborhood.
He was super cute. He was the strongest sense of morality we'd seen. He was a good guy. He had their backs. Yeah, in any other movie, that guy for sure would have been the love interest. He would have gone into the party with them. It would have just been an ongoing thing.
What's also hilarious is that Chris Columbus like loves that Blues Club scene so much that he does it again in the Christmas Chronicles, that Netflix movie he made with Kurt Russell as Santa. They do that entire scene again, but in a jail cell.
But by the way, here's the thing. This is the thing that makes me so angry. Like, and I agree, like there are problematic things, but the most problematic to me is that everyone in that Blues Club is won over by that song. like, come on. Like, it's not that great. And I just am so thankful that it wasn't them rapping. Like, for the time, the fact that they sidestepped them all rapping is huge. Giant. Like, we have to talk about the restraint that took for them not to be, like, beatboxing. Oh.
I wanted them to scan through the audience and me to just see Bruce Willis kicking it back there. The only white guy in the whole place.
Playing a little harmonica.
Yeah. This one, in rewatching, because I also loved this movie, and and I remember watching it young and feeling much more identifying with them, and watching it old, it stood out to me, like the things of noticing their ages, or also that girl has a 15-year-old brother and she's pretty much almost old enough to stay home alone. Why the shit does she need a babysitter in the first place? But one of the things that, because this movie's PG-13, and I honestly several times was thinking, who is the audience for this? Because there are several jokes that are dark or more adult skewed. There's this running joke about how she resembles the current Playboy centerfold. There's a offhand comment of the underage sex worker that they just had an interaction with. Anthony Rapp says an aside like, you wouldn't believe what she would do for $50. And I was like, who is this movie for? I loved it. I don't know if I got it, but there's also like one of the kids is 9. It was a very weird blend of things.
But you know, when you think back to like a movie like Splash, like Playboy was also like a part of Splash. And I think even Big has like a Playboy in it. Like that felt so like a part of these movies in a weird way. And I think that that's also because you probably have like a 30 plus a white, straight white male. So going, let's put in a Playboy, like make it like real, you know, like it's that element of sex or like taboo sex or something. I don't know. It's weird. It's a weird thing. It's as weird as them listening, like that Elizabeth Shue would be dancing in her room to like an old 50s song, which was something that like I grew up watching movies where people were always like, you know, 60s and 50s songs. I'm like, no, that's only because they couldn't afford the songs of the time. So they're just dropping in these old needle drops and being like, yeah, that's what the kids do. And I'm like, yeah, like I didn't do that. Like, what was I doing? Like, yeah.
White women singing into hairbrushes old Motown songs is a great cinematic tradition.
It is. She's her moment in this is almost one of, it's her singing to "And Then He Kissed Me," and it might be the gold standard. She's perfect. It's the perfect opening.
She's amazing.
To a movie that's about this is to as get good bonkers.
As Yeah, this is as good as it gets. But, you know, you're right. Age-wise, this movie is all over the map. And what's funny is that it is technically a Disney movie because Touchstone released it. And so, like, it will be on Disney Plus at some point this year, but minus F-bombs. And I think it was – somebody must have loved the "don't fuck with the babysitter" line so much that they were willing to go to a PG-13 just to keep it because
– By the way, twice. You only get one fuck normally on a PG-13. They did – she's like – he's like, "don't fuck with the lords of hell."
Yeah.
And she's like, "don't fuck with the baby." It's like double down. I was like, "That's a." I don't know if it's because of the proximity they get too, but that's really rare to get double fucks.
Well, you know, that was that Disney Touchstone energy, so they're able to get it. I actually really like that scene. I like. There's something about like the. As someone who grew up in Compton, seeing like the Hollywood portrayal of gang and street life in movies, like it was like watching. Like the gangs they portrayed were so West Side Story that it was really funny and it was like cartoonish. And I actually really did enjoy that scene. And I like, and that's always my favorite bit is like someone forced to stay in between a group of people fighting. Like they refuse to let the person leave. They're like, "no, you got to stay here and watch us fight." Like that's a trope I really love. So I was all about this scene.
By the way, what do you think though of this? Like, I also think of this era, it is pretty bold. To have like, I think like a fully fleshed out female lead in like a comedy. Like, I feel like Elizabeth Shue is funny. She's like a stronger character. She's got obviously like, I mean, I don't know. I think that she's, it's just a different thing that you're used to seeing in comedies. I think the only other movie I can think about is like Stop or was it the Babysitters that Don't Tell Mom the Babysitters.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
right.
You know, like, but it's so rare in this
the
time.
The Christina
to see,
Applegate?
Like, yes.
Yeah, it is unusual for these to have a female lead. And Elizabeth Shue is like, you know, after literally sleeping through Back to the Future 2 or whatever, you know, it is great to see her like kind of claim center stage.
Well, this was before then, wasn't it? I thought this was one of her first, it's definitely her first leading role. But it's also crazy because it was just like a year before Cocktail, which really brings out how much younger they wanted her to play in this. I agree, though. I think I think she's a great female lead. And I also like that, truthfully, like the Penelope Ann Miller character, who's her best friend, who's run away from home, who's at the bus stop, who's like the, you know, the inciting incident because they have to go into the city and save her. And her, you know, she's got some great comedic moments, too, of like her glasses.
Oh, yeah.
She gets misplaced and she picks up. I have
described that
before.
Oh, yeah, that glasses bit was such funny, yeah.
Oh, it's done really well. She handles it well. But I've also used that as a marker when I'm trying to explain to someone exactly how I feel. That is a great one of, "oh, I feel right now like I put on the wrong glasses and I'm just petting a rat in the middle of a bus station." That's my emotional state. So I like that. But she, you know, that she's a nice comic relief. And they're both women and meant to be teen women who are performing roles that we didn't see a lot of, that we still don't see a ton of.
No, and I also think that like what these movies do really well, and I think why they hold up to a certain degree, and obviously there's always going to be things that date the films, like we talked about, just from like weird, you know, just things that are problematic. But I think one of the things that these movies do so well is create really fully fleshed out fun characters. So as they are going through each set piece, you're meeting somebody really great. And I think that Vincent D'Onofrio scene with the man with the hook hand, it's set up kind of so perfectly. She's telling the story about a man with a hook hand. They get stopped by this guy who seems really intimidating. He's not that intimidating, but then he becomes really intimidating. And it's like they really play up and down, but the characters are fun. And Joe Gibbs is another example of that. Like everybody that they meet has a little bit more personality than I think a lot of the bland cookie cutter versions of this movie that don't necessarily work. And I think that that's something that Christopher Columbus and John Hughes do really well, which is like imbue the ensemble with like, you're like, "oh, I remember that person from that movie." That's why Macaulay Culkin, who's in Uncle Buck, stars in Home Alone. You know, it's like you start to see the people pop from these movies and doing smaller things because they think they are actually fleshed out, or at least given a moment to really shine.
There's a great energy to the film. There's a lot of humor, I think, that holds up and isn't, you know, cringy. And yeah, absolutely. I think the performances are good across the board, even if, yes, there's definitely some weird age casting going on. You know, I loved Jim Henson's Anthony Rapp baby in this movie. Like, he's such a little, you just want to pinch his cheek.
Scooter. He really does look like Scooter in this movie.
But he's like already like has this sense of comic timing and is a lot of fun.
His line, I love his catchphrase. It was like, you think? And yeah. what I really love, by the way, and this is like a small detail, but someone's always laughing in a moment of crisis in this movie. Like, there's always like, what are you doing? Like, you know, it's like when the car hits a flat and there's like skidding out, Anthony Rapp is just like laughing maniacally. The little girl is laughing like crazy. Like, they're all like in these like panic moments. And I love like that people don't really keep their cool or are freaking out in a different way. Like, even when Anthony Rapp like makes Steve Coogan go up there and fight the gangs, he's like, wait, what are you doing? Like, it's like there's a sense of play to all the scenes that I don't know, like maybe grounded. I mean, it's heightened, obviously, but it's it feels playful to me.
Yeah, there's an after hours version of this movie that is not very funny at all.
Yes, right.
On that note, let's give our final reviews of our final review of Adventures in Babysitting. Would you screen it, rent it from Blockbuster, or skip it?
I would say this one would be a rent it from Blockbuster for me. I think it stands up so well and is really fun. There are enough questionable things in it that it's one of those. The only reason I wouldn't be more encouraging is because I think it's the kind of film, if it's already in your head as something you love and a memory, you might be better off just pondering that memory, because sometimes when you unseal one of these and you're like, oh, huh, a lot of homo jokes, and then it's not as fun. But there's a lot of greatness to this, and it was a very enjoyable read, and I will definitely be thankful forever for that moment of meeting Thor, because I'm sure that unlocked a many a guy and gal's sexual awakening. We owe it.
I'll make it a Blockbuster night. This is a movie I think that I previously had a greater level of affection for, like Dre said, so you should maybe not have opened that box again. But I think even with the stuff that I now find a little discomforting, it's still very sharp and funny and very well edited and well structured. And, you know, just it's just super charming. You know, it's hard not to be charmed by the whole thing. It's breezy. And the weird thing, I think, is like I would recommend it to somebody who would want to watch it as a nostalgia piece. I can't imagine showing it to an actual young person now without a million footnotes.
You know, it lives in my brain as something that I really love. So it's hard for me to separate. It's like, is Back to the Future a great movie? I don't know. Karate Kid, like all these movies, Beverly Hills Cop, like they're ingrained in me as something I watched over and over as a kid. So it's hard to like peel myself away from it. But the one thing I will say, as I've grown up and now have kids and they have watched Home Alone and I watch them respond to it, is these movies on a level hold up because I think they're actually really well written. And that doesn't mean that like the homo joke is well written. It just means that like structurally they are sound films that know how to get you in and out in 90 minutes. It feels like they're creating fun characters. I think if you're a writer or something like that, you can always learn from how kind of effortless they are in tying little loose ends in and all these little subplots. I think John Hughes is a kind of a really amazing master of this. Doesn't get spoken about that much as far as like a structure point of view. So definitely a rent for me.
Oh, those are good opinions, y'all. But I don't know about y'all, man. It's March 1987. I was just hanging out at the Improv. I saw Eddie. He was working some jokes out. He said he got a special coming out in December. He said he was going to call it Undone. I suggested calling it Raw. I don't know if he's going to run with it or not. But, you know, based on the times and everything, this movie is A-okay to me. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I'd say definitely rent it. I definitely think it's like not for lack of a better word, prolific enough to say, like, you have to screen this, you have to see this. I think it's a good rant because, yeah, it is a good, if you can, like, preface it and be like, look, there's going to be some wild things in here, but just know it was wild. And if you want to know how wild it was, we'll watch Eddie Murphy's Raw right after this. and just know we're out of our minds and just a little less empathetic in the 80s. But, you know, now people can speak up on Twitter and let us know how they feel.
I'm fascinated that Iffy was able to be advising Eddie Murphy at a time when he was a zygote in his father, especially as a zygote is a fertilized ovum. And yes, I'm going to science call you out for that.
Waited so long to drop that. Yeah, you waited so long to call me out. Well, you know what? Speaking of zygotes, we zygot to go. And we're about to do some staff picks from 1987. It's time for some staff picks. It could be any movie, but our one rule for this episode that it must be from 1987 or around there. Paul, why don't you start?
Oh, wow. You're coming to me first.
Oh, yeah. Coming in.
Boy, oh, boy. You know, this is, like I said, a really tough year. I've teased it a little bit. Evil Dead 2, Raising Arizona, Princess Bride, all these movies that really were big influences to me. But I think the movie that I've probably watched the most, it's maybe a close tie, but I'm going to say I love Lethal Weapon. And I'm gonna shill for Lethal Weapon, Mel Gibson, Danny Glover, a movie that comes out and is not necessarily popular in the theater. It's darker than you would expect for like a buddy comedy. It is kind of lighter on the jokes. If you know about Lethal Weapon now, I think you probably look at it and you go, oh, the movie's with like Joe Pesci with blonde hair. It's like this first one is like the Rambo or the First Blood to Rambo 4. It's just a really well done Richard Donner, like a little bit of a hard boiled buddy cop movie with some like good jokes and some kind of great performances. But this movie like opened my mind and made me obsessed with all things like action and buddy cop, and I think is probably subconsciously led to my creation of like NTSF SDSUV. Like I just I love this world, I love this genre,
and it's the first of the Shane Black Christmas movies.
Yes, and again, yeah, you're right. And Shane Black, I mean, how could I forget Shane Black? I mean, he's so, I mean, and I'm a huge Shane Black fan, so yeah, that movie really holds a special spot for me.
Ooh, that's a very good pick. All right, what about you, Drea? I know you got a spicy one.
Yes, mine is relatively spicy. We did actually mention it briefly. My staff pick is The Witches of Eastwick. I love this Ooh. Film. Ooh. It stars Cher, Michelle Pfeiffer, Susan Sarandon, and Jack Nicholson. Are you kidding me with that? And I love, there's always that thing, I don't know if it's for everyone, but like I'm always a little besotted with any movie where the women all have hair colors that are drastically different. I find it very cartoonish and wonderful. And it's directed by George Miller, who has my favorite weird range of films. We've mentioned, you guys know how much I love Mad Max Fury Road, and the idea that that same guy made Witches of Eastwick. It's based on a novel by John Updike, which is crazy Pulitzer Prize winning author, and it's so fun and specific, and it is, you know, it's saying a little about like gender positions or whatever, but it's just wonderful and ridiculous. Veronica Cartwright has like the most amazing unhinged performance in it. If you watch it or if you think of it, like the cherries scene will stay with you forever. Their whole weird pregnant utopia in his mansion. There's so much in this movie. The Witches of Eastwick. It's a great little escapist romp.
I got to see that again because I saw it having read the book and I was like, what is this? But I think now that I've forgotten the book because it's been so long since I've read it, I can approach it on its own terms.
Yeah, you should. Get on that.
Yeah.
Alonzo, yeah, what is your 1987 pick?
Well, I have a couple. I mean, I I'm old. I remember this year with great specificity. Part of me wants to say Hope and Glory, which is John Borman's recollection of growing up in England during World War II, which is a lovely movie. But, you know, it was a Best Picture nominee. He doesn't need the shilling for me. So I'm going to dig a little deeper and talk about The Stepfather, which is this great pulpy serial killer movie starring Terry O'Quinn long before he was on Lost, but already giving an incredible performance as this guy who is obsessed with the sort of like perfect idealized Reagan era suburban family. He marries single women with children, installs himself as the bland father figure. And when the families disappoint him, as they inevitably do, he murders them and moves on to the next one. It is a very effective horror movie, but also a really brilliant kind of social satire and one of the few original screenplays written by the great mystery writer Donald E. Westlake. So Shelley Hack, an actress I've always liked, you know, doesn't get nearly her due, pops up in this one as well. But yeah, if you've never seen The Stepfather, the original from 87, it's great.
It is. I second that.
I also agree.
You know me, just a little babby in here. But you know, once again, it's 1987, and there's been this movie I've been hyped about that's coming out this year. You know, it's this like up and comer. Really been every movie by him has been a smash. But I have to say, this Full Metal Jacket has piqued my attention, and I'm really hoping that you know it really does well. Hopefully, it becomes a hit that people remember. You know, it has that Vincent D'Onofrio character we were talking about. I heard about it in the trades. So, you know, who knows what can happen? This one might come and go, but I think this one might be here to stay.
A bold bit.
I don't even know where to go with that one.
I could tell how solid it was by the complete silence that it received. So,
yes, we no-butted you, Iffy.
Yeah, it's all good. It's all good. Paul, I just got to say, thank you so much for joining us. Is there anything you want to plug before we get up out of here?
No, I loved being here. I'm such a fan of this show. I think you guys are awesome, and thank you for having me. The one thing that I've been doing, because I think we all have been stuck in our house, is I got this like texting app thing. It's totally free. It's not like Cameo or like OnlyFans, whatever. It's totally a free thing where I basically have been giving people like a nightly pick, like whether it's a movie, a TV show, or a book or music. So if you like just text at me like picks, you can check out. I just give you a nightly pick. We're all stuck in quarantine, so why not you know, judge me by the picks I'm giving you, or at least you know, have somebody help you out through the thing. But you call me at 917-877-0657, and then like I said, it's totally free. There's no odd side of it. It's a kind of just like social media, but without hearing all the people that are bots and stuff like that.
Yeah. I'll just go on and throw this plug in here. Check out Black Monday if you want to see lots of great wigs, lots of great mustaches in that show. So peep that.
Thanks so much. Yeah, Don Cheadle, Regina Hall, Andrew Annals. We have so much fun. It's a good show.
All right, before we go, I just want to say thank you once again for all our members for supporting the show. We truly appreciate you 100%, though.
And it is super easy to join those folks who have already become supporters. Just go to MaximumFun.org/join. If you haven't become a member yet, perfect time to do it, and that's where you go, MaximumFun.org/join.
For everyone listening, again, the number for the Who Shot line is WSY-803-1664. And just a reminder, you can buy a Jumbotron on our show by going to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at Who Shot Your Pod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/ Who Shot Your Podcast, or send us an email at WhoShotYa@MaximumFun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.